As health workers treat patients suffering from COVID-19, scientists are working to figure out medicines that can ease symptoms or prevent the new coronavirus from spreading. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with a professor who studies infectious disease, and we want to hear from you. What do you want to understand in the scientific fight against COVID-19? What questions do you have about how researchers are working to understand the new coronavirus? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Do you think scientists should aim for therapies to help COVID-19 patients, or should we focus on preventing the virus from spreading? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Bill Sullivan is a professor of pharmacology and toxicology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. He studies drug development and infectious disease, and he's also the author of Please to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and the Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. Bill, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. It's great to be back on the show.
Thanks for being here. We now know that the FDA has granted emergency approval for two drugs for COVID-19. These drugs are usually used to treat malaria. What do we know about them and how effective they are in treating the new coronavirus disease?
The two drugs you're referring to are fairly synonymous. You're talking about chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. And hydroxychloroquine has just been tweaked a little bit to be a little safer so that you can use more of the dose. Both of them are an old malaria drug. They've been used since the 1940s. They are well tolerated at therapeutic doses, but they do have a very narrow window of safety. So it is easy to overdose and cause potentially fatal arrhythmia. So we do want to be careful with these drugs. We certainly don't want to encourage people to hoard the drugs or self-medicate. So what's interesting about them is that they are now being proposed to have activity against coronavirus, which is a very different germ compared to a single-celled parasite that causes malaria.
And, I mean, the clinical trials are usually required for approval. Those have just started. So these drugs have gotten approval to be released a lot faster than they would in normal circumstances. What should we make of that?
That's right. These are called repurposed drugs. That's different from discovering a brand new drug when you don't know that the brand new drug is going to produce certain side effects. You don't really know how safe it's going to be. But chloroquine has been used by tens of millions of people, mostly to treat malaria, for decades now. And so we know how it works. We know what doses are effective, and we know what sort of side effects to expect. Since we know so much about the drug already, we're able to fast track it without doing all the previous safety studies that usually take a lot of time in drug development.
Sure. So we know how the drug works with the human body. It sounds like what we don't know is whether it could actually be effective in fighting the virus that causes COVID-19.
That is correct. And that's a very important point that we should stress here. There's a solid rationale for why chloroquine might work against this virus, and clinical trials are underway, as you said, but they just got started. So no one has proven that chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine works just yet in this capacity. And we don't want to deprive people who have an established medical need for chloroquine from their medication. These would be malaria patients. Chloroquine is also used to treat arthritis and lupus because it has potent anti-inflammatory activities. And of course, we don't want people to self-medicate. Everyone has probably heard the story about the gentleman in Arizona who took a form of chloroquine that was used to clean aquariums, and that was actually a fatal dose.
Right, because he thought that was what he was looking for and what he had heard from politicians, including President Trump, saying, well, maybe this is an option for us. So that self-medication can be really dangerous.
Yes, we definitely don't want people to do that. And we don't want other health professionals or people asking their doctor for this medication because there's no evidence, there's no solid evidence that it works just yet. It works very nicely in a laboratory setting in a test tube, but we don't have the evidence yet that it works in people. And science has been fooled time and time again. When something looks good in a laboratory, it doesn't necessarily translate to practical use in a person. So we need to be more patient and wait a few more weeks, maybe a few more months, to see what these clinical trials reveal, because the early results that are coming out of it are mixed. Some studies suggest that it does seem to work, and others are suggesting it doesn't have any effect.
Bill Sullivan is a professor who studies infectious disease, and we're talking about developing drugs for COVID-19 patients, and we are taking your calls. If you've got a question, dial 800-642-1234. Let us know what you want to know about how researchers are working on this. And let's open that up then, Bill. Where are scientists looking right now to try to combat COVID-19 and its symptoms?
Well, there's two other major approaches that scientists are taking in addition to the repurposed drugs. Repurposed drugs are a really good option because they can shorten the severity and may be used as a preventative too, which our healthcare workers desperately need. We really have no defense right now against this virus. So the two other avenues that scientists are currently exploring, a vaccine would be the best. That would be the holy grail here because vaccines confer safe long-term immunity. Unfortunately, that's also going to take the longest to develop and test. Plasma therapy is another one that is being talked about increasingly in the news. This involves taking serum from someone who mounted a successful immune response to the coronavirus. This is kind of like helping someone cheat on a test. You're giving another person the answers, in a biological sense. You're giving them the antibodies that they need, to beat off the infection. And when you get someone else's antibodies to the virus, they're going to bind to that virus and help destroy it. Your body would eventually make its own, but because we differ genetically from one another, some people mount a better or faster response than others.
And you mentioned vaccines are far away. Would a therapy like that be practical?
It wouldn't be the most practical. Vaccines would be very simple because they're usually just a one-stop shop. You know, you get your shot and you got long-term immunity for some time. Drugs are also very convenient. You can usually take an oral one and for several days and you'll be done. Plasma therapy is different because you have to harness serum from people who successfully beat the infection. That takes time, and that means there's not a lot of it just yet. And then to put it into someone, you can't just give them a pill of that. That actually has to be done through an IV infusion, and obviously that's not very practical. So this is the kind of therapy that will probably be used for very desperate cases, very life-threatening situations.
And Bill, we know researchers are trying to figure out whether people who get COVID-19 are immune or if it can reoccur. What do we need to do to figure that out?
Time will tell. The signs are looking good, though. There's no reported cases that I'm aware of where someone has come down with COVID-19 twice. And it does seem the virus genetically seems to have a very low capacity for mutation, which means, unlike the flu, it doesn't change a lot. So it seems to be relatively stable, which is good news in terms of long-term immunity, because if you're talking about a virus that changes a lot, that means it's going to be like the flu, and every year it's going to be different. We're hoping that coronavirus, at least the one that causes COVID-19, is more stable and will not change very much, and therefore the immune responses that we build will protect us from year to year.
Bill, thank you so much for walking us through this process and catching us up to where we are right now in those labs. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Flatten the curve, everyone.
Bill Sullivan is a professor of pharmacology and toxicology at Indiana University School of Medicine. Up next, we're talking with our WisconTex team about how Wisconsin healthcare providers are taking testing into their own hands as they see more COVID-19 patients. And we're taking your calls about the situation, 800-642-1234. Do you work in a clinic or hospital? Are you able to get the tests for patients you suspect may be infected with the new coronavirus? 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Checking the weather forecast, a winter weather advisory will be in effect from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. west of a line from Rice Lake to Durand. Freezing rain and sleet may cause a tenth of an inch of ice and slippery roads in the advisory area, highs in the 40s there. In the rest of the state, cloudy skies with rain showers and highs from the mid-50s to around 60. On Saturday, the South could see a little freezing rain in the morning, then sunny skies expected across Wisconsin, highs in the 40s and 50s.
This afternoon on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll get recipes and cooking techniques inspired by Native American traditions here in the Midwest. That's Food Friday, today on Central Time from 3 until 7.
Support for WPR comes from Boardman Clark, a Wisconsin law firm serving businesses, communities, and individuals. Attorneys committed to listening with intent so clients can act with conviction and chart the best path forward. BoardmanClark.com.
Do you have a comment to share with WPR? Contact our Audience Services Department by sending a letter or postcard to Audience Services, Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706.
A new report from our WisConTex team reveals Wisconsin is working to catch up on testing for the new coronavirus. It details how public and private labs are ramping up testing for COVID-19 after early missteps at the federal level meant local health providers couldn't meet the testing demands. It's the Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. We're learning why testing is a crucial piece to public safety. And here on the Ideas Network, there's a line for your questions. What do you want to know about this coronavirus outbreak? Ask a reporter who's been following the pandemic from the beginning. And have you tried to get a coronavirus test? Were you able to? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. Will Cushman is associate editor at WisConText and has been reporting on the new coronavirus pandemic now. Hi, Will.
Good morning, Keely.
Thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Scientists say that being able to test many people for the new coronavirus is key to getting this pandemic under control. How many tests is the state doing every day?
It's doing certainly more than it was at the beginning of March, or even up until kind of mid-March. Right now, we're seeing anywhere between maybe around 1,500 to somewhat over 2,000 tests being conducted per day in the state. That's a lot more than I said in the beginning of March. It was more like 1 or 200.
And is that the number of tests we need to be doing because that's how many people are seeking tests? Or is there a cap on that because of the supplies that we have or the time that we have and are able to test people?
Right. That's a really good question. There is a cap that's primarily associated with a severe limit on the supplies for testing. And that cap means that a lot of people who may want to get tested, who are even symptomatic for COVID-19, may not be getting tested. And that's because public health officials really want to prioritize the people that they think really need to be tested. And that includes hospitalized people, healthcare workers, and a few other groups of people.
So Wisconsin is testing as many people as we can. What is the problem? What is the shortage that we can't get more testing done?
Yeah, I talked to some people at public health labs in Wisconsin, and I've talked to scientists who have developed their own tests for private health systems in Wisconsin. And they all say that we are short on pretty much everything that is required for testing. So that's everything from people to do it to all the materials that are involved. There are a lot of materials that are involved in testing, everything from these specialized swabs that you need to use to take a specimen. They're called nasopharyngeal swabs, and they're these like long, really flexible they look like long, really flexible Q-tips that you, like a healthcare worker, will stick up your nose to reach your nasopharynx, which is where they take a specimen. Those are in really short supply. Also, the liquid that is required to keep a specimen viable on its way to a lab is in severely short supply. That's called viral transport media. There are a couple substitutes, potential substitutes available for that now, but that is pretty limited. And then all these ingredients that are involved in analyzing specimens during the actual testing process are also limited. Those are called reagents. That's basically just a scientific word for some sort of substance or material that can cause a chemical reaction. And these chemical reactions do a whole bunch of things. They extract the viral genetic information from a specimen. They amplify it, and they help lab technicians identify whether the virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which causes COVID-19, is present in a specimen. All those reagents are in severely short supply as well.
All right. We have a call now at 800-642-1234. Shane from Eau Claire has a question for us. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, you guys. Thanks for taking my call. If I understand correctly, viruses like the common cold, you never actually get cured from. You just carry it with you, and you get well over it. So I wanted to know if this coronavirus, you know, all these people, we hear about, oh, people are getting well and people are dying, but does that not mean that they're still carriers of it? Could we still not get infected from other people then? And then would it not just be inevitable that everyone's going to get sick eventually? Thanks.
Yeah, Shane, thanks for the question. And Will, has any of your reporting delved onto this side of the viral conversation?
Not so much. I am aware of kind of like anecdotal evidence potentially that maybe some people who have been infected have potentially gotten reinfected, although that's kind of definitely up in the air and uncertain at this point.
Right. And our last guest actually, you know, did mention this too and said that he wasn't aware of any confirmed cases where this had happened, but it is something that scientists are paying attention to. So it sounds like that's
right.
A question that we still have yet to answer, Shane, which I guess is the answer to a lot of our questions right now as we figure all of this out. Will Cushman is associate editor at WisConText and has been reporting on the coronavirus pandemic for months. If you've got a question, email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll try to get to it in this conversation. Will, we know that there are two public labs that are doing testing right now, Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene and Milwaukee Health Department. There are also some hospitals doing testing, right?
Yes, there are. There are actually a whole bunch of private labs in the state that are doing testing. Some of them are affiliated with hospital systems and some aren't. A whole bunch of hospital systems in the state have basically, because of the shortage in testing and kind of the bottleneck in the public health system, have turned to doing their own tests, whether it is developing their own tests, getting approval from the FDA for tests that they've developed in-house, or purchasing commercial test kits from lab supply manufacturers, which are also becoming increasingly abundant.
I mean, are those tests at hospitals, private labs, different than the ones being done at public facilities?
They're essentially the same test. I talked to a scientist from Mayo who was involved in developing their test, and she described it basically as their tests are like a home-baked cake, whereas the tests that come from the CDC or from a commercial test lab are like a boxed cake that you would buy from the grocery store and bake on your own. You essentially get the same product, but the ingredients or the process might be a little bit different.
We know that in the beginning, when testing was even in shorter supply, it was also a really long wait to get test results, like days to even a week. What are we looking at right now? Are we still in that position?
Right. It was taking, upwards of a week in some cases. And from what I understand now, at least through the public health system, so those public health labs, the one in Madison and Milwaukee, they're saying that they have a turnaround time right now of 1 to 2 days. Now, that doesn't include the time of transport. So if your specimen is coming from way up in Ashland County all the way down to Madison and back, that could take definitely longer than a day or two to get your results back. But I know that one of the goals of these healthcare systems who have started doing their own testing is to speed up that time between when a specimen is taken and when results are received. Health systems want to reduce that amount of time as much as possible because it helps patients understand A, their health status, and then B, their potential risk for spreading this disease.
We've heard about some new tests that could provide results maybe even within minutes. Are we seeing any of those used in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I am not positive, but you're right. There are a couple of manufacturers that have gotten approval for tests. There's one from the manufacturer known as Cepheid that has gotten approval for a test that takes just 45 minutes to get results. There's another one from a manufacturer called Abbott, which they're promising results in as little as 5 minutes. I don't know. So the ability to run these tests kind of depends on the instrumentation that's available in a lab. I don't know how many labs have these instruments, but I do know from an official I spoke to at the state hygiene lab that quite a few labs in Wisconsin and nationwide and around the world run this Cepheid instrument that would be able to get results back in 45 minutes. Not sure if any of them have gotten those tests yet, but it's certainly promising.
With expanded supplies, although still limited, who's actually able to get a COVID-19 test right now in Wisconsin?
That's a really good question. Ultimately, right now, it is up to your healthcare provider to make that judgment call. There are guidelines from the state, and they want to prioritize people who have severe illness and who are hospitalized. They want to prioritize frontline healthcare workers who are symptomatic, as well as people who live and work in long-term care facilities, so like nursing homes, as well as people who are deemed to be at high risk for the disease, whether it's high risk for complications, so because they have pre-existing medical conditions, or at high risk for contracting the disease, meaning that maybe they have a travel history that puts them at risk, or they have had known contact with someone who is known to have the infection.
Does it seem to matter where people live and how they have access to testing?
From what I understand, not necessarily, unless where they live is means that they are around or contacting people who have confirmed infections, if that
sure.
makes sense.
So not on the testing side, but on the exposure, adding to those the criteria that one might use to get the test. That makes sense.
Exactly.
Well, we know that you're working on top of this and digging really deep. Thank you so much for helping us better understand your reporting.
Thanks for having me, Keely.
Will Cushman is an associate editor at WisConText and has been reporting on the coronavirus pandemic for months. We've got a link to his article. You can also find it at wisconText.org. Up next is news. Then we'll look at how families who rely on social services are coping with this stay-at-home order and what providers are doing to fill the gaps. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that 8 out of every 10 deaths due to COVID-19 are people who are 65 or older. Other people most vulnerable to severe symptoms from the new coronavirus, people with existing health conditions, compromised immune systems, or lung issues. We're talking about how organizations that care for aging people and people with disabilities are managing their residents and their staff as this virus spreads. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. And here on the Ideas Network, we want to hear from you. Do you rely on social services to get the care that you need? How has COVID-19 affected that? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Think about stay-at-home orders and whether you need food delivered or you have a home health aide. Perhaps it's about physical therapy. How has this affected your world? Go ahead and call 800-642-1234. Maria Ledger is Chief Executive Officer of My Choice Family Care, Care Wisconsin. It's one of 4 managed care organizations in Wisconsin, and it helps senior citizens and adults with disabilities manage their home and community-based long-term needs. Maria, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me on.
With the current stay-at-home order in place by Governor Tony Evers, how has that affected the services that you're providing across the state?
It's meant that we have to do things differently. We had to shift fairly quickly. As a managed care organization, we serve about 16,000 members throughout Wisconsin, providing the family care benefit in 39 counties, and we have about 2,000 members for whom we provide something called partnership, which is long-term care, which is family care and acute and primary care in 8 counties. And we had been preparing as we knew that COVID-19 was becoming an increasing threat. But I don't think any of us in Health and Human Services were prepared for quite how quickly it escalated. But we had been putting together our own incident management task force. So we were able to have a lot of our care management and nursing staff deployed and working from home to make sure that we were still able to support the people that rely on us to coordinate their services and be able to manage as the stay-at-home order became effective.
Yeah, and I could see, though, that working remotely would have major challenges, and there are some things you simply can't do to care for people when, you know, you're on the other side of a computer or a phone line.
It is a challenge. I think it was less of a challenge for our care management teams because our expectation has always been that they don't work in our offices as much as they work in the community. We want them to be accessible to our members, but that means that they see our members quite a bit, and so now they can't. For the people that they work with who are living in facilities, they're not able to see them unless it's a critical need. So we're trying to respect those guidelines that say they don't want visitors, they don't want people bringing in a potential exposure. So we're relying on Skype visits and phone calls, and we're checking in very frequently. But if you talk to our care managers and nurses, they're doing that, and they're being able to ensure that people are safe and well. But it's hard because you miss a lot of those nonverbal cues, and it's hard to get as much of a connection as they had, but it's the place that we find ourselves in. I did talk to one of our care managers who works with a population that's deaf and hard of hearing. So what she's had to do is go to her member's house and stand a distance outside and sign to her members through a plate glass door so that she could still have a level of communication with them and still be a safe distance away. So they're becoming resourceful, more resourceful than they had been.
Yeah. Well, and I understand, you know, you assist with providing long-term care for people with physical and intellectual disabilities in addition to senior citizens. What are the things that your workers do? Help us get a good picture of that.
So what the care teams in all of the managed care organizations do, and as you had said, there are four throughout the state of Wisconsin. And when people come into those programs, they enroll in them through the what's called a resource center, and those are found in every county. And what happens then is a care team will come and meet with a person and talk with them and design a care plan and find out what it is that individual needs to meet their outcomes, to be as independent in the community as they can be. And then through the provider networks that we establish, the team will arrange for the things that you need: transportation, durable medical equipment, residential services, supported employment services. They'll put together all of those things, and it's not a one size fits all. Every plan is very individualized to the person, and then the managed care organization, through a contract with the Department of Health Services, it reimburses those providers for the care that they give to the members. So now, obviously, there are some things that our enrolled members aren't receiving. They can't go to those larger congregate settings because of the safe-at-home order. So congregate meal settings, larger recreational opportunities, working in the community for individuals who had supported employment, those are things that aren't available to them right now. So it's a very different way of people interacting and the way that we're being able to provide services, and it's a very different landscape for our network of providers as well.
Yeah, and certainly if you can't do something and it is an emergency or imperative that your staff members are still connecting with clients in person, are you providing them with any additional pay or support during this time? Because it is a little bit intimidating, I think, to be in the category of essential employees when the mandate for everyone else is stay home and don't be around other people.
Right. So for our staff, what we're they are for the very most part, the folks that work for My Choice Family Care, Care Wisconsin, have not been taking any risks in terms of seeing individuals. We would love to have been able to provide them with all of the personal protective equipment that we could. But we're in the same position that most people are in terms of not being able to have as much as we want. I know there are some supplies that have just been made available through the state. We had tried to order some very early on, actually in February when we first became aware of the impending health crisis, and our order was lost in transit. So, again, we're trying to make sure that we minimize the risk on our staff.
Your order was lost in transit?
Yeah, I'm using lost as a euphemism, but that's what it was called. It was lost in transit, and it never quite got here to our office. So that was what happened to ours. But again, when we ordered it, we assumed that we'd be going out more into the community to see members, not realizing, you know, what was going to happen in the space of 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But it is a challenge for those providers with whom we contract, who are having daily contact with individuals because they are providing services to where people live. So it's something that we're trying to work through right now. And I know the state of Wisconsin is having conversations with the legislature and with the federal senators for Medicaid and Medicare services, and really everyone's trying to navigate this for the first time ever. This is just a completely unprecedented event, and I think everyone is really trying to do the best that they can as quickly as they can. It's completely, to say it's uncharted territory is just a wild understatement.
Maria Ledger is Chief Executive Officer of My Choice Family Care, Care Wisconsin, helping seniors and adults with disabilities manage their home and community-based long-term needs. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What is the most crucial piece of care that you receive that you've had to go without right now? How are you filling the gaps? Share your story with us. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Maybe you're a family member of someone whose care has been affected by this stay-at-home order. How are you trying to help them? Help us understand how you're managing. You can email us, too, at ideas@wpr.org. And Maria, you work with not only family members but also healthcare providers, and I wonder what you're hearing from agencies about the concerns right now.
What we're hearing from our provider network is staffing concerns, and again, this is something that we were anticipating as soon as schools closed, because it was in. When it became an issue for our staff, obviously we knew it was going to be an issue for everyone's staff, that with school children at home, families were going to be impacted, and so there were going to be staffing issues. There's staffing issues as individuals become at risk for exposure or potential exposure. So we have some of our provider agencies are short-staffed. If you have a residential facility where the people that live there had typically gone out and done other activities at other placements during the day, and those opportunities aren't open to them any longer because those were larger congregate settings, and the residential facility hadn't traditionally had first-shift staff, and now they have to, that's a pressure on them. And then we have to think about what is going on with that day program. If no one's attending there, we still want to make sure that that program is going to be open and viable when this health crisis passes, whenever it does. So there's all kinds of very critical financial questions that, again, have to be answered, and we understand fully that they have to be answered really quickly. And we have as many questions as our provider network does as well.
Maria Ledger stays with us. Yeah, she oversees one of the largest family care organizations in Wisconsin. And we're taking your calls to 800-642-1234. Are you providing services right now? How are you staying safe? Maybe you have scaled back a bit. Help us understand what it looks like for you. The conversation continues here on The Morning Show. Caregivers play a vital role in supporting people who are aging and people with disabilities. They are the definition of essential employees under this stay-at-home order in Wisconsin. We're talking about how organizations are handling supporting clients and for the people who work with them. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Still time for you to join this conversation. Call now at 800-642-1234. Tell us how this stay-at-home order has affected you. Has it changed what you can access physically? Maybe it has had an impact on your mental health. How are you still able to get the counseling that you need? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And John from La Crosse wants to join the conversation. Hi, John.
Hi. I've been listening to this interview. I'm a immunocompromised person, and I deal heavily with an organization in Wisconsin, Inclusa. I just am a little concerned hearing this interview as a on top of it client who goes out of his way to do well. I have not even received a single call from my caseworkers, my nurse, social worker, and anything in concerns to this, the COVID-19 situation. And as I said, I'm immunocompromised, I'm not even getting calls. Although I do want to state I appreciate the severity of the situation, and I do understand. I just also want people to know that they need to check on their loved ones in these situations and not rely on just the social work team. But I do want to repeat, I have not even received a call from my organization. I had to call them and inquire about sanitizer or what to do, and there was no readiness plan, and that was last week. I just got, we're looking into it, and that's concerning. So I appreciate what you guys are doing for the people that you can help. But things are hard out there, and I would encourage family members to do all they can to help their people that are in and friends in these situations right now.
John, thank you so much for being willing to share your story with us, because it is John's experience. John is saying it's great that you're trying to reach everybody, but I've fallen through the cracks here.
Oh, sure. And I've I was going to mention it's, you know, there are very different experiences, and I'm sorry that you know, that has been his experience. There are, as I mentioned, four organizations like mine throughout Wisconsin, and it's often a very different experience. Not talking about whether his contact with his care manager, but just the experience of how services are provided from a rural area to a more urban area. I know when I spoke to actually one of our care teams in the La Crosse area, it's because individuals may be so spread out. That's where technology has really become a challenge. There are some areas they were sharing with me where there isn't really much of cell service at all. So it becomes where when home visits aren't possible, and you have to rely on technology, that's where, you know, this particular situation has become even more difficult. And they did say that Spectrum has really stepped up in that respect and made it more possible for case managers to touch, reach out and touch their members. But to John's experience, I'm glad he has been able to get out and contact his care manager. And I guess I would say to anybody who hasn't heard from their care manager, from their nurse, from their care team, if they are enrolled in a long-term care program, to absolutely reach out to them. If they can't reach them, if you're enrolled in a program, there's ombudsman who are able to help you make those connections. All of that information is online. And again, there's for people who aren't necessarily currently enrolled in a program. If you look, every county has an Aging and Disability Resource Center, and all of that information is readily accessible online. So that's your Aging and Disability Resource Center is really everybody's one-stop shop for all of the things that anybody is eligible for, whether it's family care or partnership, or the state has a self-directed supports waiver called IRIS. All of those things your counties can explain to you. So, and even though everybody's working remotely, everybody still has access to all of that information, and so people are still taking calls and can still provide individuals with that kind of guidance.
That's Maria Ledger, CEO of My Choice Family Care, Care Wisconsin, serving people across the state, 39 members in 39 counties, almost 2,000 members in partnership in 8 counties. And so, Maria, what are the questions, though, that we should ask if if we're advocating for a family member, or if, you know, we're in our caller's position where we can advocate for ourselves? You know, what are the questions we should be asking, and what expectations should we be setting given the circumstances?
I think we want to ask people, you know, make sure that they have connections. What we've established a protocol for our care teams, questions they should ask when they're contacting their members about whether they have enough resources that currently available, you know, whether they've got food in the home, whether they've got people that they can contact. And again, sometimes people are expressing needs, and clearly we've seen people who don't have long-term care needs, people who are, you know, perfectly functional and healthy in the community, who have reacted in a way and gone out and completely overshopped at Costco, who don't have a real realistic appreciation for, let's just say, how much toilet paper they need right now. So what you want to find out is, if you're concerned about somebody, you know, do they have what they need? Do they have enough food in the home? Do they have a way to access their medications? Do they know who they should call if there's if they have an emergency? You know, do they have a way to reach you? We try to make sure that even if we're calling someone in a facility, if the facility isn't able to get back to us right away, do we have a secondary contact? But to John's point, people should really be checking in on our friends and neighbors, making sure they're all right, that if there's anything that someone can do for someone, even if you're just someone that can shop for someone and leave groceries or needed supplies on somebody's front step so you don't have to go in. There's a lot of ways, I think, that we can be resourceful and helpful to one another, but we can also help people make those connections and find the services that they need. And I'll say this, there's a lot of people across the state who have stepped up at an unbelievable level. There's two sort of volunteer groups that are sort of separated geographically that are, they're a wide network of primarily women who are sewing fabric face masks and are just turning out hundreds and hundreds of them for first responders and hospitals, and we've connected a lot of our providers with them simply because personal protective equipment is so hard to find. So, you know, shout out to the masked sewists and the face mask warriors, because they are working overtime and turning out these masks that are so critical to everybody.
Right, because they're not medical grade, but the theory is it's better than nothing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then, just as we wrap up, for people who rely on social services here in Wisconsin, what should we take away from this in this moment?
I think that for people who rely on those services, the services are there. We're trying right now to provide them in a different way. Schedules may be different, and the way that you receive services may be different, but people's care managers and nurses are there and available by all means, reach out to them. If you're not getting the kind of response that you want, there's, you know, everybody who has services has a handbook. They know how to call and express concerns if they're not getting what they feel that they need at this very moment. And if you feel like you do need services and you haven't accessed them up to this point, contact your local Aging and Disability Resource Center, because that's where you're going to find all of the options. But
thank you so much, Maria. I'm sorry we have to wrap up. Maria Ledger is Chief Executive Officer of My Choice Family Care, Care Wisconsin, talking about long-term care and healthcare needs right now. Thank you so much, Maria. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.